This week on Best in Show, Sean Fennessy joins us from the Ringer podcast to kick off award season. But first, a message from our sponsor. This episode of Best in Show is brought to you by G-Kids. It has been 10 years since his last feature film, and the legend is back. Academy Award-winning director Hayao Miyazaki returns with The Boy and the Heron, a fantasy about life, death, and creation, and it's his most personal tale yet. Gemma, you've seen it.
Yes, and loved it. The Boy and the Heron has bicycles, budgies, grannies, a gorgeous pastoral life and incredible fantastical elements. There's grief, there's love, and of course, there's music composed by Miyazaki Sensei's longtime collaborator, Joe Hisaishi.
Yes, and there's also Robert Pattinson doing a wild voice as the Heron. The new Studio Ghibli film features an all-star voice cast including Christian Bale, Dave Bautista, Gemma Chan, Willem Dafoe, Karen Fukuhara, Mark Hamill, the previously announced Robert Pattinson, and Florence Pugh. Catch it in both English and Japanese when it comes to theaters and IMAX on December 8th and see why critics are hailing this as a new masterpiece.
Woohoo!
Hello, and welcome back to a brand new season of Best in Show, a limited podcast series brought to you by The Letterboxd Show. I am Mia Lee Vicino, the West Coast editor here at Letterboxd, and Best in Show is all about awards season. We have a new HQ on Letterboxd, letterboxd.com/awards. I feel like I've said Letterboxd 20,000 times in the last couple sentences. Make sure you follow us there on Letterboxd for lists and updates between episodes. Letterboxd, Letterboxd, Letterboxd. Throughout the series, which will run weekly until March 2024, we will be having conversations with contenders from this year's movies, interrogating insiders about the film awards ecosystem, and we'll be diving into the Letterboxd data to see what's spiking. So, if you listened to last year's debut season, just know we are back at it again, doing what we love to do here at Letterboxd. Celebrate cinema. But this time we are even more emboldened because now we know Paul Mescal is a confirmed loyal listener. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Paul.
Hello.
And here, as always, to celebrate cinema with me are my Best in Show besties. Please welcome back Hollywood veteran and our editorial producer, Brian Formo.
Hi, Paul.
And hello again to our editor-in-chief, Gemma Gracewood.
Hello, Paul. And hi, Mia.
Hello, Gemma. Hello, Brian. And get this, our team is expanding a little bit this season, if you want to tell us a little bit more, Gemma.
Oh, well, more is more, Mia, so why not? As close listeners of Best in Show well know, we do have our favourites going into awards frenzy season, even if we know that The Quiet Girl will never win against All Quiet on the Western Front. She is still my Irish darling from last year's season. And it was a great privilege to get to talk to a lot of the makers of those films. So this year, we are going to spread that conversational love across our wider team, the people you often hear on the Letterboxd Show podcasts. You'll hear from podcast besties Mitchell Beaupre, Ella Kemp, and even the man with the tape deck himself, our editor Slim, alongside other members of the Letterboxd family, as they have delightful chats with cast and crew and Paul Mescal from this year's best films. And we're mailbag positive this season. If you have questions about any of the categories, any of them, send them in to podcast@letterboxd.com. I feel like I'm saying Letterboxd a lot as well. Is this
I'm telling you. Podcast?
And we, except when I say it, apparently it sounds like litter box. Anyway, it's
Letterboxd. Like a cat.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, send in your questions. We'll do our best to get them answered by current contenders and past winners of major awards, just depending on what your questions are. Like, if you're curious about production design and how it gets judged, or acting, like how do you judge one performance against another? Send those questions in ASAP because we have upcoming episodes on those exact topics.
Yes, and I'm going to bring Brian in here because we talk a lot about how Best in Show is not a participant in the horse race. We don't like to pick winners or predict outcomes. We just like to champion our faves and make sure some of the lesser seen contenders are on our radars. But it's been a weird year due to the industrial action and AMPTP's incredibly slow, drawn-out, eventual okay-fine agreement of SAG-AFTRA and WGA contract demands muted conversational excitement around contenders. It's a little funky right now. So Brian, bringing you in, where's the conversation at?
Oh, I mean, we might not be talking predictions, but the ponies are back on the track. They're racing around. The actors are back heavily promoting. They are making it incredibly difficult to, it's a good problem to have, but incredibly difficult to manage how, who gets to talk to who, when, where, why, because they're all after months of not campaigning, or even just like promoting their films for the theatrical release. Now they're in the grind of trying to woo voters. And they've already wooed Letterboxd members, to be honest, because a lot of the biggest players for this season potentially are some of the highest rated films on Letterboxd. Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, Oppenheimer, Poor Things, those are all very much in the conversation. So is Killers of the Flower Moon, Past Lives. So like we're going to be speaking to a lot of artisans who are working on some of your already favorite films of the year, but we also are going to try to make sure that we are serving the quiet girls with a little bit of the taste of things that we love as well.
Ooh, your eternal memory for film titles is sending me. You are a scrapper in the podcast camp.
That actually weirdly was the film I was just looking at when you said that, because I'm looking at the list of films that are currently winning awards, which will be live. Currently, it's mostly some small guilds. The Gothams are happening the day that we record this, which you can probably find the answer who won those where, Gemma.
Oh, you can definitely find them on our awards HQ, letterboxd.com/awards. And also we have, this is amazing news, speaking of the wider Letterboxd family, every Friday, if you have your Letterboxd notifications turned on to receive our emails, you will get a specially written Best in Show newsletter from our pal George Fenwick, who is an awards tragic just like the rest of us, and who will be writing his reckons from the week and then including every episode of the show and recent journal stories and four favorites videos we've done with contenders out on the carpet. It's a whole thing. We're going big this season.
We've also got an award season 2023 to 2024 list, which will go live the same day as this podcast. I have been toiling over it. Just know that all of those notes handwritten by me, Mia Livaccino. So check it out. And you can even follow along while you listen to us talk about these movies. You can look at the list. It's interactive this year, y'all. We're leveling up.
All you need to know is there are 1,001 reasons to keep listening to Best in Show this season, and that evil does not exist here.
So this is actually kind of the perfect moment for me to ask you guys for your faves of the year, but I'm not going to because I'm pretty positive that we will not be able to shut up about them throughout this season, and our faves of the year will become very, very, very apparent pretty quickly. So instead, I'm going to ask this week's special guest. Bring out Sean Fennessy. Sean Fennessy needs no introduction, but hey, let's do one anyway. Sean is kicking off our season for many a reason, not least because he is the head of content at The Ringer, the host of the Big Picture podcast, and the frequent co-host of The Rewatchables. Hello, Sean, and welcome to Best in Show.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. I do love award shows, sadly, for me, but hopefully not for you. So hopefully this goes well.
Well, that's exactly why you're here. And to start it off, I want to ask you something that we ask a lot of participants on Best in Show, which is, what was the first award that you ever won?
I've heard you ask this before, so I've prepared. When I was in fourth grade, I was asked to participate in a contest that I think was issued by the recently elected President Bill Clinton to generate, and actually I think Hillary was behind this as well, to generate a more healthful society. And so we had to construct the most healthful meal that we possibly could, like, and draw it. And there were like hundreds of thousands of submissions across the country. And I won like a silver medal for the meal that I composed, which I would not describe myself as a particularly healthful person. I am like Michael Fassbender in The Killer, just like eating hard-boiled eggs out of plastic bags. But when I was in fourth grade, apparently, I had some vision of some sort of like protein-based meal. And
tell us, we need to know about
we
this.
We need details, Sean.
Fantasy feast. What's in it?
It's so pedestrian. I honestly think it was like grilled skirt steak and string beans and lightly mashed potatoes. Like it was so
lightly.
It would not strike you as healthy. But you've got to remember that this was the four food groups era. You know, a far less advanced era of scientific food management. And so for whatever reason, they plucked me from obscurity, and I went to New York City and I got a medal, and I didn't meet Bill Clinton, which I guess is probably for the best in retrospect. But that honestly might be the last award I ever won. I can't recall another one.
Was the silver medal placed over your head on your neck?
I believe so, and I honestly think my mom cried. Which is
this is amazing. Did you get to give a speech?
No. Thankfully, no. Maybe that's why I won't stop talking now. But It was surreal. It was very strange. And I thought that this was like setting up a life of award receiving, and just not the case, unfortunately.
I have a gold medal to award you right now, Sean Fennessy, for describing my all-time favorite meal.
Is that up there for you?
Yeah.
Steak, just meat and potatoes?
Green beans and a lightly mashed potato. I mean, who doesn't want that?
It really doesn't expire. I mean, it is just magnificent for 100 years.
Yeah. It's like, it is the genius plate of food. So there you go. You're a winner again today. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
So then the next question, I guess, is, was that around the same age that you got obsessed with awards in general? Or do you remember the first time you became aware of the Oscars as a thing?
Yeah, it must have been. Must have been 9 or 10. I think Brian and I are very similar in this way. But I think, you know, starting to see Siskel and Ebert on TV, starting to subscribe to Entertainment Weekly. My grandmother lived in our house, and she lived in the apartment above our house, and she was an Entertainment Weekly subscriber. And my mom worked, so my grandmother watched me all the time, and she would come down and read the magazine, leave the magazine downstairs. I would read the magazine. And invariably, there were Oscar previews. And the way that Entertainment Weekly conferred importance upon these things cannot be underestimated for my generation. Like, it really, they just hammered home that the summer movie preview, it was like the new gospels had been passed down to 11-year-olds. And I bought them hook, line, and sinker. And the same with all the awards previewing. And I can't recall, honestly, the first Academy Awards that I ever saw. But I do know that Billy Crystal is kind of etched in my memory as the kind of face, voice representation of what that show was. And yeah, I've been a loyal watcher ever since I first discovered it, probably about 10 years old.
And was there a particular movie that also got you hooked on the silly little cycle? Like, was there something that you were particularly rooting for and then got really invested in?
Yeah, I was allowed to watch A Few Good Men before I should have. And so that is like, that's kind of a signature film of a lot of the shows that I'm on. And I think feeling like that was the perfect representation of American movie making, which is kind of what the Oscars was all about, right? Like occasionally they would glance at international cinema, but it was really just a Hollywood show. And that felt like the Hollywood 90s movie, you know, big stars, a big important moralizing story. The good guys win in the end, kinda, but there's a little hint of regret in the story. So Nicholson's performance, obviously, was so widely lauded, and he just kind of took over that movie, and that speech took over the legacy of that movie. And it felt like it probably signaled awards bait to me, even though it ultimately was not a very big Oscars movie. It felt to me like it should have been, which probably led to a life of me saying that certain movies should be in the race that aren't, and movies that are in the race shouldn't be in the race. So here we are.
I was going to say, my introduction to A Few Good Men, like so many movies of that era, was first through The Simpsons, but
oh my God,
before I had seen it. But you actually... Wasn't A Few Good Men your first selection in your lawyer draft?
It was. I selected Daniel Caffey to defend me in the event that my life was on the line. I'm not sure if that was a good pick. I've been told it was not a good pick because, in fact, Caffey doesn't actually get the guys off entirely. They do get discharged from the military. Nevertheless,
but if it was your first big movie when you were 10, then you know it's in the heart. So like that makes it even more sense that it was your first pick.
Yeah.
So before we start getting into the nitty gritty of award season, I mean, we're all curious about how you specifically use Letterboxd. So I want to go over some of your four faves because I know that you shake it up every once in a while. Like for example, last month, Flower Moon month, you had a personal journey with Martin Scorsese through American movies in every slot, which is incredible. I watched that whole thing as well and I loved it.
I loved your interview with Martin Scorsese, by the way. It was so great. I thought it was fantastic.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. And that interview was why I needed to see him talk about movies for 3 hours straight. To prepare. And I'm so glad I did. Those were your picks last month. But now you've shaken it up once again. It's All That Heaven Allows, Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, Something Wild and Jackie Brown. So is there a theme this month?
Sort of. The theme is not quite what you think they are, I think is the idea of all four of those movies that all seem conventional on the surface, that are all ostensibly about people in middle age or approaching middle age, kind of coming to grips with who and what their life is. And then having that life disrupted meaningfully by
Melanie Griffith.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Yes. Or Ray Liotta, you know, yes. you could see it that way too.
Rock Hudson.
Yes. I mean, Rock Hudson. Exactly.
I mean, Rock Hudson could shake up my life, but I'm not his type. So, you know.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, for me, it's Pam Grier, you know, like we all have our types. But yeah, so I think sometimes I try to theme it up. Sometimes it's purely an ode to the maestro. Sometimes it's just four movies that I think are cool. I'm not programmatic about it, but I do like to change it up a lot. I think just because it's how I use it, which is that I just look at other people's profiles and I'm like, What don't I know? What haven't I seen? What does this say about you? Why do you care about this?
What do you think about one of Letterboxd's newest members, Martin Scorsese, and his picks, his lists?
I definitely went through all the editorial stuff that you guys did with him, which I thought was fascinating. Like he talked about, I think with you, Mia, he talked about Blood on the Moon, which I had never seen before, which I thought was such a fascinating movie, and I love Mitchum, so that was like a great discovery.
Did you watch it?
I did. Yeah, I did.
Oh, very cool. Look at that. The Great Marty watch list bump.
It like unlocked something for me that I had not realized about Killers of the Flower Moon, or not that I maybe I just hadn't seen it through the prism of it being a noir, you know, that it being a kind of a cowboy noir, a Western noir. I hadn't been thinking of the movie in that way. I think in part because I had read the book and when I saw the film and realized like, oh, this is kind of an inversion on the femme fatale. This is kind of an inversion on like the dopey guy who we're following through the story as he enters an underworld that he doesn't realize. Like it follows a lot of the conventions of those kinds of films. It has a very cynical view of how the world works. And again, like that's why I love A Personal Journey with Martin Scorsese so much too, is because he in that series locates theme inside of story, which is the thing that like as I get older as a movie watcher, I'm most interested in. He continues to inspire new watches for me all the time.
Because this is in your four faves right now, and you already had brought up Entertainment Weekly, I wanted to say I distinctly remember the very first issue of Entertainment Weekly I ever got, which was the fall movie preview that had Jackie Brown on the cover. I actually just read Rum Punch for a book club. It's kind of an odd book club pick, but it was a bunch of screenwriters, and because the writer strike had ended, we wanted to read a book that was adapted that we hadn't read before. And it's not a hot take to say that Jackie Brown is Quentin Tarantino's best movie anymore. And I do agree with that, but I think because he's like, oh, I can only do 10 movies and then I have to be done, he should start adapting other works. His adaptation of Rum Punch is fantastic. Having read the book, like everything he adds to it and what he takes out is like perfect.
Yeah. I think there is a world in which he will write scripts but not direct them. I do think that that's very plausible because he just loves to write so much. I was an Elmore Leonard reader before I was a Jackie Brown viewer. Actually, the movie that got me into Elmore Leonard was Get Shorty.
Oh, yeah.
Same. Because I loved Get Shorty as a kid. And I look at it now and I'm kind of like, why did I love this so much? But nevertheless, I got really into Elmore Leonard's novels and I read like 10 in a summer because they're just so compulsively readable. They're like 80% dialogue. And Rum Punch was one I really liked. So when Quentin announced that he was doing that as his next movie, and I was completely Quentin Tarantino pilled at that time, post Pulp Fiction, I was kind of confused because that book is, you know, is a character piece and there's crime in it, but it just didn't feel at all like Pulp Fiction to me. But he did something really beautiful with it. And I think people are still kind of marveling at like what a mature work that is from a mm-hmm. guy who seemed honestly not very mature at that time. And
that how, time?
Like, I'm sure. I mean, but like, it's the way it portrays people in their 50s and 60s is amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like, those are characters you don't see in movies now. We almost never see characters like that in movies. Mm-hmm. So it's such a unique movie. And it's definitely among my favorites, if not exactly my number one.
I have one more Letterboxd question that I'm really, really dying to ask you. So I know that you are a big fan of Fincher because you loved The Killer. We already got one killer mention about the eggs.
Maybe not the last.
Yeah, maybe not the last. But I was curious. I was creeping on your stats a little bit, Sean, and I noticed that you have watched David Fincher's Mank 5 times.
Mm. What about it?
I'm just curious. It's your most rewatched film, and I just want to know more.
There are a few reasons for that. Well, the film was released in 2021, which was a very dark time.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
And I host a contemporary movie podcast, and there were not a lot of contemporary films being released. And so, you know, full disclosure, I was desperate for good movies. Like the whole idea of the show is to promote what's exciting about new movies, modern movies. Mm-hmm. And Fincher is my fave, as I've talked about. Fincher and Paul Thomas Anderson are the kind of like the brain and the heart of my interest in film. And I had been following that story of the development of that movie for a long time. He had talked about it before, about his father and the relationship to it. And so I was really all in on the movie. I think because of everything I knew about it, because of how much I loved Citizen Kane, because of how much I had read, you know, Raising Kane and the making of Citizen Kane, I had like read everything about it. I love Wells. Actually, when last time I talked to Gemma, I talked about a Wells movie when we did the four favorites.
So you mean the Wells movie with the SpongeBob SquarePants theme tune?
That's
what you said. Yes, the third man. Yes. Wells was there with the zither. Carol Reed was there with the zither well before SpongeBob. Anyway, so I was really primed for that movie. I was the target audience of that movie. It was David Fincher doing a movie about Wells making a movie and a screenwriter. And, you know, so I loved it. It was my favorite movie of that year. So it meant I watched it, I think, 3 times in that year. And then I don't even know when this is airing, but I was asked by my friends on the Blank Check podcast to go on and talk about the film on an episode that's coming up soon. So I revisited it again for a Blank Check episode.
Because you're the Mank man. You're the main Mank man.
I'm the Mank man. I've staked my claim as the Mank man, which is, you know, pretty embarrassing and lame.
No. Mank needs its defenders. Like, I'm glad that somebody is running the Mank hive.
Thank you. I mean, I think it's great.
Yeah. And I mean, if you look at your Sean Fennessy's 3 recent lists, it's all right there. You've got David Fincher ranked. You've got The Killer list, which is films that double well with The Killer.
I love that list, by the way. Very, very cool. You. Chronological order. Genius.
Ah, amazing. That's how I do it, and then the third list in there is Men, Alone. So it's, you know, like...
I was in a state of mind preparing for The Killer. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
But speaking of staking claim, now we have to ask, what are your top 3, if you can get it down to 3, films of 2023 so far?
It's really hard. I've been doing my list, and I will be doing an episode about it, I think, in a few weeks. I've been a very vocal proponent of Oppenheimer, and as a longtime skeptic of Christopher Nolan, I think he's been very hit or miss for me over the years. And when he hits hard, but when he misses, I tend to be baffled by the kind of consensus around him. And I think
how do you feel about Tenet?
Very pro. But again, very pandemic pilled on that one. You know, like I drove to a drive-in in San Diego to see that movie.
Sean, did you do that too? I drove to San Diego to see it at that drive-in. That's beautiful.
I mean, that's what we had to do, right? To thrive in that time.
No, we didn't in New Zealand. We had no COVID. We locked down. We kept the rest of the world out.
Stop
and
bragging.
We went to see Tenet in the IMAX as it should have been seen over the week.
Nice.
How was it on the cinema screen, not on the drive-in screen? Was it good? Did you like it? Did you not like it?
I mean, I liked it. I just, my review is pretty much like, all of cinema is now about trying to find a different way to go. Here's a madman who wants to do a mad thing. How are we going to stop them? And this is just the latest and greatest version of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Part. That's fair. That is fair. I did like Tenet quite a bit. It felt like him kind of like very clearly addressing the critics, which I kind of like when filmmakers,
yeah,
you know, do that. And Oppenheimer felt like him kind of, I think, figuring out what he likes about the tools that he has, mm-hmm. and then applying it to something with some import. I think he's done a lot of genre stories over the years and has like tried to import some meaning in them that I think kind of slips through your fingers when you try to hold on to it. Like Inception and Interstellar are the two movies that I've always kind of struggled with the most of his. And I know that those movies are beloved, but I don't really think that those movies are really actually about what he thinks they're about, or he's kind of like overselling the theme. Oppenheimer is a real story. It is something that actually happened. And so
I'm pumping my fists because I'm on that Interstellar train with you. Like, here are some very specific letterboxed facts about Interstellar. It is we run a fun piece of data every year, which is the movies with the most fans on Letterboxd. Mm. So you know, basically people have put it in their four favorites. And Interstellar comes out on top every year, and every which way we run the stats. So we can also run them with people who have selected she, her pronouns, people who have selected they, them pronouns, to see how the list changes. And of course, you know, all of the, what did you call them? Tarantino-pilled people tend to have a lot of Tarantino in the he, him list. But across all of the gender lines, Interstellar is beloved. And I kind of get it. I get why, but I just don't get the film.
Yeah.
Jim and I were just slacking the other day about how we're meh on Interstellar. I rewatched it this year. For the first 2 hours, I was like, was I wrong about Interstellar? This is actually pretty solid.
And then
the third act starts, and then the dust and the shelves. And I was like, when Nolan reaches for Heart, I think he's not leaning into his strengths. And I'm similar to you, Sean. Like, I loved Oppenheimer, and I've never really loved a Nolan movie. I love a lot of his craft and technician skills, but this one felt like, because it was so much about process, it was perfect for him, and how it was about like the parallel running of two different types of processes with fission and fusion and like all of that. It was like the perfect film for him. And I think whenever he tries to be a human is when he like stumbles. And this was the perfect one to not do that and just be about the brain.
Because you have to sort of put humanity aside in order to build a bomb.
Yeah.
That's going to do that.
Yeah.
I guess maybe as communicated by my men, comma, alone list, like portentous men in rooms talking movies, not just men, but all people talking in rooms is like
mostly men, let's be honest, in terms of the directors. I mean, that
Oppenheimer,
you're choosing,
it's a lot of men.
I mean, Sean Fennessy, name a woman.
I'm drawing a blank here.
I don't know if there are any women.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
I'm not sure if they're out there.
No, I think this happened to me last time I was on the show too, and I reject the premise. You know, my co-host is a woman. I host a great many women.
Yes,
we love Amanda. In fact, if you could just see what Amanda's doing right now and just hand the mic over to Amanda.
I think right now, she's actually now seeing what is another one of my top three favorite movies.
Perfect segue.
Which is, this is what I do, Mia. She's seeing May December, which I was like knocked out by.
Oh, name a woman. Name a woman.
Name so many women.
Yes, truly. Or women, bountiful women. Just binders full of women. Yes. Todd Haynes' women. I thought this was an extraordinary movie, and I'm still chewing on it. I saw it a few weeks ago. I am a massive Todd Haynes fan. He's been on the show four times.
Sean, we have a question for you. Brian, Mia, and I, just before we jumped on with you, were talking about how May December feels like 2023's Tar. Not because it's about bad women, but because it's about, you know, it's that chewy, really sinewy kind of, you know, study of people in the world. And of course, we had a brilliant nickname for ourselves last year, courtesy of Mia Vicino, Tar Heels. What is our May December fan club name?
Oh, it's got a tough one.
We got to come up with it by the end of this interview.
Okay, I'm going to brainstorm
May
on that.
Decemberists, like the band. Yeah. But we can do better than that. Good. No, we that's can do good. Better than that. That was just my first thought.
Decemberists are from Portland, like Todd Haynes.
Oh,
see, you may have it. You may have it. So you guys love it too.
Oh, yes.
That's I just saw it a couple days ago. I covered the carpet last night. I loved it. I can't stop thinking about it. I can't shut up about it. Yeah, we are very pro May December.
I saw it way back because I live in a part of the world that gets all the Cannes movies fresh for our particular region's film festival. So I saw it way back in early July. I've been sitting on my hands waiting for this moment. Let's get in there.
I hate that feeling when I've seen something and that no one else has seen it and you're just dying to communicate. And this one in particular, I completely agree with you. It's just like Tar in that what you read into it will be an incredible personality test. And it will say so much about who you are and what you think the intention was and what Haynes wants to say about the character and what Sammy Birch wants to say. Like the also like a beautiful, magnificent time, like a time capsule of a time capsule. Like it feels like someone looking at the 90s while living in the present time and you're getting to watch them do that.
Yeah.
So I thought a fabulous movie and so perfect for him too. Like, whoever located him as the person that could tell that story with Julianne Moore is
Natalie.
Is she the one? I mean,
Natalie Portman was the one who delivered it to him because she loved
so
the script.
She'd
been trying to work with him for many, many years and he passed on everything. But yeah, really liked this. This is my movie of the year. I can't stop thinking about it. I've already seen it multiple times. By the time this podcast is out, there will be a Todd Haynes interview out that's like in the Marty version of talking about films that informed it, which is great. I think it's one of those movies like Tar that it's great while you're watching it, but when you're unpacking it, when you're driving home, when you're talking about it with friends, it just expands and expands. And I love those films.
Yeah. The more you learn about it and the people involved in it, like knowing that Sammy Birch is a casting director.
Yeah.
Like that is it right there for me. When I walked out of the movie and was like, okay, who was this? Who wrote this? Mind explosion right in that moment. You're like, we're going deep. We're going deep into the process here.
I can't, it raises like an interesting issue. I wonder how you guys think about this, doing a show like this. I want to be able to do episodes of the show that I do that are just full of spoilers, you know what I mean? Where we are talking in full about all of the ideas and events of the film and kind of what they mean and what they represent. But we live in this like up and down culture where people are receiving things at all different times. Mm-hmm. It was easy to do it with The Killer because I knew that when The Killer went on Netflix, everyone was going to watch it. And it has been in the number one movie on Netflix for over a week, which is great. That's wonderful. A movie like this, I wonder if you have to bang the drum a little bit more loudly to get to draw attention to it, because it seems like it is like a kind of a confection, like a tabloid confection, but it is a really like a Bergman psychological drama. Like it is really, it is not a conventional Netflix movie by any stretch of the imagination. So I hope a lot of people watch it so that more and more, so then we can all kind of talk about it together in a way. Like that's what I look forward to with this one.
Well, actually with this, we can say the day that this episode comes out, December 1st, is when May December is on Netflix. So watch it right now.
Perfect.
Or watch it after listening to the rest of this.
and let's also say that Tar never had the advantage of landing on Netflix or another, you know, global streaming platform.
It did appear on Peacock. Which is not as good.
Eventually, yeah. And so it was hard to talk about that film as well because you didn't, there were so many great theories and think pieces coming out and I would just be on the Letterboxd reviews every single day going, hey, did someone else get obsessed with the number 5 in this film like I did? But you couldn't actually say that, right? Because you don't want to spoil things for people going in, but at the same time, not enough people were going in. So how do you?
I think the slow bleed is honestly not a bad thing. It's just knowing when to have the conversation about something is an interesting conundrum when we're making a show like this, because you want everybody to feel like they can participate. And like when I say a movie name and you guys all laugh and you're like, yes, like we all, but like no one in America has seen May December.
Right. It's so,
literally 812 people have seen the movie total in America.
Hey, so maybe what we need is a Letterboxd Ringer crossover spoilerful weekly conversation for those who wish to.
I love it. I mean, what I really want is like a machine that lets people see the movies right away.
Yes.
I'm so crushed when people are like, I'll just wait for it to come to blank service. I'm like, go see the movie. What's stopping you? You know?
On that note, I'd love to tease a feature that may or may not, at the time of this podcast going out, already be available to patron members to test, but showtimes are coming to Letterboxd.
Oh, exciting.
Yeah, it's well past time that you'd be able to be on the May December page on Letterboxd and immediately be able to see
that it's on Netflix.
In your neighborhood, that it's on Netflix. Or that it's still on a big screen while also being on Netflix. You know, okay. Fingers crossed.
So you'll be geo-targeting where I am at any given time based on my zip code. And then I can, that's cool. That's great. Mm-hmm.
All right. What's number three?
I think I haven't been able to shake Across the Spider-Verse. And I did rewatch it on the Netflix streaming service this week. or I started to stream it. I should be honest, I didn't finish it. But I was just as taken with it there. And when I saw the movie in theaters, as a childhood comic book reader and someone who has grown increasingly disenchanted and disenfranchised from comic book movies and comic book storytelling in the last 5 years, I'm just really moved by this franchise and by the kind of boldness and weirdness and the absolute majesty of the animation. It is like absolutely on another level to me in terms of what film animation can be and its willingness to kind of break the paradigm and not let the viewer focus on any one thing. Like, I'm thinking about this a lot because I'm bringing my daughter to her first movie on Saturday. She's 2 years old. We're gonna go see Wish. The new Disney movie. And I haven't seen it. I don't know. And I'm very excited about that. And part of the reason why I want to take her is because it seems like a very conventional and understandable Disney film. It's like, it feels like a traditional animation style. It's a princess film. There's a lot of things about it. And I've heard that it is actually a little bit more subversive than that, which is great. But I was trying to imagine when my daughter is like 11 or 12, how much further will a movie like Spider-Verse go? Like, what will we be able to anticipate and understand visually? Because you could never have imagined a movie like this when I was a kid. You could never have imagined that you could fit this much information, that it could look, be rendered this way, that it could have the sense of humor and the sense of drama. It always feels a little silly to oversell a comic book movie. They made like $500 million, but I'm like a real believer in this particular franchise and like the way that they have decided to pursue it. Because they're not trying to make like $1.8 billion. They're trying to make $500 million, mm-mm, which is weird. That's actually quite unusual in terms of the stakes game in contemporary Hollywood. And so because they know that there are some limitations, it helps them creatively to tell a different kind of story. So I've just been knocked out by that movie and I'm circling it. I don't know if it'll actually be my third favorite movie of 2023, but it's something that I just adored the first time I saw it.
I love a movie that immediately gives everyone else permission. Mm. You know, it's not just here's a world using tools you've seen used before, but, you know, to tell a slightly different story with some different actors. This is creative permission to do more, to stretch further.
Yeah. And I think it probably will pay dividends for animation long term. Mm-hmm. It kind of needed to happen in a film this big for us to kind of brace ourselves for what could be coming. And done in a way that I don't think is like leveraging an attention deficit that we all have. Like, I think it is kind of using that as like a tool. It's like a superpower to the film that I really appreciate. And I'd never really seen before until the first one. And then the second one just kind of ups the ante. And also telling a great, great story.
Those are three beautiful picks. They're also three quite big boys. Is there a small, an indie, a bubbling under, a something else you haven't been able to shake?
Yeah, I saw it when I met Brian at Telluride. I had just seen The Taste of Things, which I thought was exquisite and caught me completely by surprise. I didn't know much about it. I had not read anything about it out of Cannes, really. I saw a couple of people liked it, but
it had a different title at out of Cannes too. Yeah.
It did. It was a pot of few.
Pot of poop. Pot of. No, sorry.
What?
Pot of few? Pot of
few? Pot of few. Yes.
Did you say pot of poo?
Accidentally, yes.
Okay, I did. I'm just checking.
But that's
just
why checking. They changed the title. That's because it's lost in translation.
Yeah.
It's a movie by Tran Anh Hung, who like I hadn't even thought about in probably 10 years, 15 years. Like I think he adapted Norwegian Wood, which is like the last movie his I can remember. And of course made The Scent of Green Papaya and is a wonderful kind of Vietnamese French filmmaker. This is like it's a period piece about a kind of cooking chef couple. Two people who are kind of working together, who are sort of emotionally entrenched and kind of what happens to them at this critical stage of their life. And it's in that tradition of Babette's Feast and Big Night and these like luxurious food movies. But I've never seen the act of cooking shot the way that he shoots this this film. And every like all of the cliches that I could, the deliciousness of the palate, like all that shit is all like it kind of like writes itself. It's overwhelming, like how good all the food looks and how much people are luxuriating in the food. It's like it's just a lot. And also like I thought it really nailed the emotional stakes of the story. I would not describe myself as the kind of person who like seeks out French period pieces. You know, I'm not opposed to them, but that's not like my number one vein. But I thought this movie was magical.
I loved it. It was in our pick of the top 10 best out of Cannes this year. Ayanna Murray, one of our correspondents, same thing as you, says that the food is merely the aperitif to a crushing love story. Is that what you got out of it, Brian, when you met Sean at Telluride? La la la.
Yes, though I did not see it at Telluride. It was a secret screening that the press tipped off. I slept through my alarm. It was like a 9 a.m. screening. I saw it this week and I loved it. I made the mistake of this is a little LA specific, but the 10 freeway had some issues this year. So issues this week. And so I was running very late to the screening and I arrived incredibly hungry and it was torturous watching this beautiful, beautiful food being prepared. Torturous in the best way. Like I actually, in my review, I called it the most erotic movie of the year. It is just so sensual. And I love how slowly it builds to actually establishing the relationship. It's mostly just talking about Nolan. It's about process, and then you meet the people, and they have a very lovely relationship that is unique and different. I loved it. Julia Binoche, she's always great, but she is astounding in this.
And speaking of Telluride, which I would love to get in there someday, maybe someday. Sean, I wanted to ask you, I know that you're a fan of the Telluride Film Festival.
I am.
Yes. So I'm wondering, which awards body rather than festival would you want to highlight as one of your favorites as well? Kind of a little bit of a pairing. See, French culinary terms.
Meaning like which show?
Which awards body are you most fascinated by / enjoy the best / think has the best picks?
They don't have to have a show, you know, because a lot of them... No. Don't they just send out a press release going, yes, this is what we think of the best?
Well, I always keep a very close watch on the New York Critics Circle. I tend to think that that's like, for obvious reasons, like a collection of thinkers that are simultaneously trying to recognize the moment in movies while also trying to subvert our expectations of what the Oscars will be. And so there's always a lot of kind of creativity that goes into that. I've always wanted to be in that room, even though I'm not a New York critic or even really a critic at all. Because I almost want to see how that's all sorted. So that's one that I watch closely. I'm a member of the PGA, the Producers Guild of America. And so I vote in that. I actually have not attended that show, though I think I'm going to go this year. And that one is really fascinating because it's extremely predictive of the Academy Awards. It is very representative of how Hollywood actually thinks. So... I've been a little bit involved in the PGA over the last couple of years and it's been a cool experience, but the award show itself is very valuable for the show that I host because that's kind of like, forgive this phrase, this is annoying, but like that's like the real Hollywood. That's like the people who like know what budgets look like, who know like who's a good department head, who's not. That's the people who are like, this guy's never been awarded and it's his time. Like you really kind of hear a lot of that conversation happening in those halls, as opposed to the WGA or SAG or, you know, the other guilds or the other critic circles. Those feel more like either acts of community or acts of taste. The PGA is like very practical body, I find.
They know how to do math. Is that the big difference?
Yeah. I think so.
They're good with spreadsheets.
Yeah, they can do that stuff. And then the creatives need a little more help.
And as you can tell by all my lists, I mean, that's my thing too. You know, I'm a spreadsheet guy, so.
Yeah. But also like the full span of a film's life from seed of idea through to the very last streaming deal.
Exactly.
Packaged with 10 other films that were, you know, made in the same year, 20 years ago.
It really does though, like it gives you a new level of empathy for the entire industry. Because I started out as a critic a long time ago and I don't think of myself that way anymore because I almost just feel like I know too much about how things are made. And it's just so hard. It's just so hard to make one thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so our instincts emotionally are to be like, ah, that sucked. Why did I waste my time with that? But if you have even a shred of empathy, and I have said publicly that some things suck. But if you have just a shred of empathy about the number of people, the amount of hours, the amount of time, it doesn't change the fact that it's a work of art. Ugh. But it's just such an incredible sacrifice for so many people that it does change your perspective. So saying it's a spreadsheet mentality feels bloodless, but it actually helps, I think, give a picture into all of the efforts that go into making something.
Yeah, no, I agree. And as a producer, a fellow producer, it is bloodless to say spreadsheets because actually that's what great production managers and line producers are for.
Yes.
And, you know, producing is so much more about like there's this thing you learn fairly early on, which is you have to trust your gut on whether it's a no or a yes. Even if a project sounds exciting, you know, on the page or in the strap line, you've got to stop and go, I am going to be the longest person on this project. You know, I'm on this much longer than the director is. I'm on this much longer than the actor is contracted to do red carpet stuff. Like this is years long stuff. And so you have to stop and go, am I in this for 10 years, 20 years, 2 years, whatever it is. And so it's an emotional decision. Because
it really is.
You got to back it all the way and in those halls. I'm really interested in that concept though of being in a group, a voting body and having one vote. It's kind of like an election, you know, a general election, you know, like how can my one vote add to tipping the balance as to whether you get Trump again or not, you know? And so that responsibility of your single vote and whether you kind of go with the group mentality on deservability or whether you go with what you actually know is the better film for a whole bunch of reasons that may include behind the scenes things that nobody knows.
Yeah, I'm happy you brought that up because it's been something I've been thinking about and trying to get underneath the surface of a little bit as we get into award season, which is that ranked choice voting, which the Academy Awards uses, has a kind of rising profile in government and the idea of shifting the way that we tally votes. And I don't want to take us too far down a rabbit hole, but there's a contingent of people that think that not just the Electoral College, but the entire way that we count votes should be out the window and we should change the system that we use here in America. And the fact that some of it is emanating from the Academy is quite funny to me because the Academy is kind of has a long history of blunders and, you know, misrepresentation. Nevertheless, ranked choice is very powerful and very effective. And like when you think about voting for this stuff and looking at the PGA ballot and trying to figure out like how I really feel and what feels like the appropriate delineation of the power of this vote, imagine applying that to something that actually matters, you know, like not this stuff that we're talking about.
The ranked choice voting is actually how my book club is run as well.
Really? So,
yeah, that is...
There's a little wave happening with it. It's quite something.
But also with spreadsheets, I wanted to ask a question from Sophie Shin, our production manager and a spreadsheet wizard, who would be all lost and probably not even here without... She wants to know, what does Amanda not like about Letterboxd and how do we change her mind and get her on there?
I mean, so she is on there and she joined. Ooh. She joined and she gave it, I think, about 2 months. And it was really... It was at my behest, of course.
Thank you for your service.
My pleasure. I think... You know, she very quickly was able to amass a following. Obviously, people love Amanda and she has very strong opinions and that's Letterboxd is an incredible place for that. I think, I don't think she would mind me saying she wants to have to do the least amount of work possible. So I think she saw it as something that was not what we see it as, which is like pure hobby and you know, kind of classifying our taste and understanding what our community thinks.
Yeah.
A tool, yes. And a celebration, right? Yeah. And I think she's like, I have a place for that. It's the podcast we do. Like, that's why we're doing it. She's also not a person who's like, here's my list of movies that I love from this year. She only does that stuff because I'm like, I need you to do this. So like, she's a real admirer of film and really understands it and loves it, but she loves it in a different way, which I think, you know, that's part of the premise of the show that we're making, honestly. And I appreciate that she tried to join, but ultimately was like, I gotta like take care of my garden and raise my child.
That is so fair. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That is actually a good point.
In addition to her job, you know.
I think I could maybe take Amanda under my wing as a fellow gardener and mum and go, look, here is how to tend letterboxed as if it were a garden, so that it doesn't feel stressful. And I'm happy to do that one-on-one. We don't usually offer one-on-one tutorials here at Letterboxd. Otherwise, we'd be working 24/7. But I would love you to extend that offer to
I will
Amanda.
Connect you too.
Yeah.
I ironically, Amanda is the more kind of fastidious, homework bound person in our pairing. And so I think she would be a natural for it. And she seemed to take to it. And then all of a sudden she just stopped. So I got to get you on the phone with her, Gemma.
Yeah. I think it's just, if it's just a diary and we're going to be introducing private forms of that for industry insiders who don't want people knowing when they saw a particular film, because then they might get harangued about what they think of it and why they're not programming it in their festival. That might tip her over the edge.
One way to get her interested would be to identify her as an industry insider. I think that she would appreciate that.
We got it.
Sean, you are a fellow Angeleno. So I love to ask people this question, which is, what is your favorite movie theater in LA? Besides those weird press screen rooms that are always in hospitals,
yeah,
which are of course our favorites. Sure. I'm curious if we have the same movie theater. So,
well, you must know that something is happening right now. That there is something in the air, like that, just like there's a boom.
Yes.
Maybe it's just a boomlet, but I mean, the Vista just reopened on Saturday.
And the Egyptian?
The Egyptian just reopened the week before that. Vidiot's just opened last year. Mm-hmm. Los Feliz 3 has been retrofitted by American Cinematheque. The Arrow is popping. Those are all like incredible contenders. You know, I moved to Los Angeles in 2012 and the Arclight was my second home. I was there three times a week. And so that will always be my favorite movie theater. When in 2007, I came to Los Angeles to do a story. It's a true story on Michael Bay while he was making Transformers. And I walked into the Arclight for the first time and I sat down with my wife for a screening of Sunshine, the Danny Boyle film, which I love. And the only other person in the movie theater was Drew Barrymore.
No.
It was me and my wife and Drew Barrymore. And we watched Sunshine on a Tuesday at 3 p.m.
Wow.
And I thought the movie was incredible. And clearly Drew Barrymore did too. And I walked out and I was like, we have to move here. We have to live here.
Yeah.
This is where we have to be. And we eventually did 5 years later. So the Arclight like always has my heart. As for now, I live around the corner from Vidiot's. I have like worked with Vidiot's to kind of like get that off the ground as a theater at the Eagle. And so I'm there most frequently. I actually even have a place in my heart for those weird screening rooms and hospitals that you're talking about, Mia. You know, like I've been there a lot. I just saw Brian in one of them a week ago. You know what I mean? Like, I'm in them all the time now. So they're not so bad.
No, they're not so bad. It's just very surreal and strange that there's also a hospital reception right next to the place you're about to watch a movie. Yes.
Yes, it's true.
I have a editor-in-chief nerdy letterbox question specifically related to Best in Show and has to be asked of you in the first episode of the new season, which is, what is a letterbox feature or tool that you find handy during awards season? Ooh. As an awards season tragic/obsessive?
Ooh. Great grand finale.
Yeah, great grand finale. What do other awards season obsessives need to get on board with in terms of organizing their seasonal activities?
Oh, I'm an inveterate list searcher. Like I am questing for other people's lists and what, like how they, I think it is like a genuine innovation in terms of, I don't know if it's film criticism or commentary or whatever it is, but it's very helpful during award season because people are just collating like everything, the results of everything. It is like, it is entering Wikipedia territory. Like if you just put my name into the search bar, it's just people are like, here's Sean's favorite movies from 2012. I'm like, who did this? Like, what, why did they take the time to do this?
Brian, it was Brian.
Yeah.
Thank you, Brian. So I find, you know, certainly for award season, like it's very helpful for looking at like the history of the best international feature Oscar. You know, there's like, there are certain categories that we kind of talk about context and thinking about how the Academy thinks and what decisions that they make and what directions they lean in. There's always that kind of like the animated feature, international feature, and documentary feature, where you're sort of like, if you're working in a predictive space, as I usually am, like, what can we learn based on what we had before? And I would rather look at Letterboxd than at Wikipedia. So that's something that I use it for.
Okay, and now back to us. Spotlight back on us. Let's talk about us. Have we, us, watched any award winners lately?
Ooh, or as I like to call this new section of Best in Show, winner, winner, chicken run dinner.
Yes, yes, the chicken run agenda is strong here at Letterboxd.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that, you know, we don't just want to focus completely on this season. Every episode, we want to have a quick look back into history and remind everyone of the awards winners of seasons past, you know, the rich tapestry of cinema.
Hey, you know who's really great at weaving rich cinematic tapestries? Letterboxd member Martin Scorsese. And he recommended a little movie called Leave Her to Heaven. I'm not sure if anybody watched this wonderful series that he has. It's a 3-episode series called A Personal Journey with Martin Scorsese Through American Movies. It's free on Canopy with a library card. And he recommends Leave Her to Heaven, starring Jean Tierney. It's kind of a proto Gone Girl. I watched it for Noirvember. And it won the Academy Award for Best Cinematography in 1946. And Jean Tierney was also nominated for Best Actress. And the film was nominated for Best Art Direction and Sound. So it belongs here in Best in Show for multiple reasons. I just want to read a really quick review from my friend Jossie, who I watched it with. XOXO, picking out the perfect outfit to throw myself down the stairs in. A thrilling technicolor vision of possession and saturation. Easy to understand how the psychological thriller could have captivated a younger Martin Scorsese.
Wow. I'm just like, 1946. This is immediately post-war. Sounds pretty dark.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's some kid gore. Sorry to Slim.
It's also very sexy. I think this is sexy movie.
Oh, well, added to watch list.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, Jean Tierney is maybe one of the most beautiful women I've ever laid eyes on. And I can't believe that she's not more mentioned, I suppose, in golden era history. Because she is a star. She is a star.
Not only is it great for Noirvember because it's noir, but also the autumnal colors and sweater game is like amazing.
Speaking of stars, I had a great award season history moment the other day when I was on a mini break with the family, turned on the hotel television, and it was halfway through Silence of the Lambs. So I watched the second half of Silence of the Lambs and then waited for the cable channel to cycle around again and then watched the first half the next night. Which is actually an amazing way to watch The Silence of the Lambs, especially if you've seen it before, I must add. So this was the 1992 Oscar Best Picture Director, Actor, Actress, and Screenplay winner by Jonathan Demigod. It's not making sense. It had me wanting to go down a Demi rabbit hole anyway. So I'm glad I got to, you know, tick this one off my list again. What can we say about it? I mean, still holds up for the most part. It's got some early 90s transphobia, which is a bummer. You know, it is a historic document. But apart from that, let me just read this review by another Demi, our friend Demi Adejuibe, who specifically shouts out the close-ups. The way Jonathan Demme shoots men in this movie is outstanding. Such a simple but unnerving choice to have them talk straight down the lens so we can sit in Clarice's discomfort. And of course, the character of Clarice is the superstar, Jodie Foster, that I'm talking about. Like, she's incredible, right? Who here is not a fan of Jodie Foster's work?
Imagine.
No hands up there.
No.
You can't have radio silence, Gemma.
Yeah.
Terrible podcast etiquette. Well, here's the thing. If you've never seen Silence of the Lambs, you need to watch her in early detective mode before the new True Detective Alaska series arrives, which is top of my TV watch list. Jodie also rightly won the BAFTA and the Golden Globe too. And I didn't realize this. I mean, at the time, it was 1991. I was a baby. But filmmaker Casey Lemons plays Clarissa's friend. And I found a funny fact. Movie Maker magazine says she has the highest ratio of lines to clues figured out in the history of film. Women.
Women.
That's all I got to say. Women.
Women.
What about you, Brian? What's been on your awards
watch list? Yeah, Brian, any women in yours?
Many, many women, but a man whose life was kind of derailed by his mother's feminist manifesto. This has trans inclusivity. So,
oh, balancing it out.
I watched The World According to Garp. Robin Williams is Garp. I had avoided this movie for forever because it was always described to me as like being similar to Forrest Gump. But that is like, and I've seen this mentioned in many other Letterboxd reviews. There's nothing Gump-like about it at all. There's
just because it's Garp. Just because it's Garp sounds like Gump.
There's no facts. There's no Elvis. There's no like inserting with presidential moments. It's just a man struggling. A man boy struggling with his mother's popularity within the feminist movement. There is an interesting.
What a struggle.
Because there's like, he wants to write about his mom, but she writes about him and says he can't write about her. So then he's like, but then I have nothing to write about. And she becomes very successful. So mentioned trans character 1982. So, in the Sean Finnessy interview before, we kind of aged ourselves a little bit. I'll age myself completely right now, just like pull off the mask. I was born in 1982. I received my Entertainment Weekly issues a little later than Sean, but 1982. So the film's released in 1982. So the 1983 Oscars, the entire every acting category had someone playing the opposite gender orientation than their sex. So Dustin Hoffman and Tootsie, Julie Andrews and Robert Preston and Victor Victoria and John Lithgow in The World According to Garp. However, Tootsie and Victor Victoria, all the characters are performing in drag for job or career purposes. And John Lithgow is playing a trans character, Roberta Muldoon. And I'm gonna read Brandon Wilson's excellent review of The World According to Garp. Let that speak to this. It's a complicated film. It clearly has deeply mixed feelings about gender and women that are fun to pull apart and work through. It seems a bit fed up with feminism at times, but also revels in its women's characters. Robin Williams, Glenn Close, and John Lithgow all do beautiful work. The handling of Lithgow's Roberta Muldoon alone shames so many films that have been made in the subsequent 40 years and mishandled trans characters. And it's true. It's like Roberta is kind of the center of the film. Everyone else is operating in black and whites, and Roberta navigates the gray beautifully and is just accepted by Robin Williams immediately. And it doesn't fall into trans trauma. 1982.
Ah. I love that, Brian. Thank you so much for reminding me of, I loved this film when it first came out and I feel like nobody else did, but I feel like Letterboxd is, you know, one of the answers to bringing The World According to Garp back around. And also, it was written by Steve Tessich, who wrote Breaking Away, one of the best cycling films ever made, which brings us all the way back to Miyazaki, who I think has a bicycle in every movie. And bikes, bikes, bikes.
Wow, this has been The World According to Best in Show. That's beautiful. Thank you so much for listening to Best in Show, a limited award season series brought to you by The Letterboxd Show. We would love for you to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts to help spread the word to other award season obsessives that this is where the great conversations are.
If you're an award season tragic like us or a newbie, we have a new HQ page to follow all of this. letterboxd.com/awards. Follow us there, and you can follow all of us individually using the links in our episode notes. And don't forget to send us your award season questions. There's no such thing as a bad question.
We
can't wait to see what's on your mind about whether it's acting, production design, or someone's outfit. We'll talk about anything.
Literally, we'll talk about anything. So the email address is podcast@letterboxd.com. Thanks to our crew. We cannot do it without you. Trent Walton for the music. The wider Letterboxd content family for getting out on carpets over the coming season and giving us the facts and the reviews. Slim for making us sound amazing. Sophie Shin for production and smart questions. And Brian, as always, our awards king for the overall production of Best in Show.
This is a Tape Deck podcast.